Good morning, everyone. Good morning and welcome to the four-day Big Book Study. My name is Bill Ditto, an alcoholic, and one of your hosts for this Big Book Study, I guess. I guess I need to read this, huh? I'm sure glad you could make it here today. I would like to open this meeting with a moment of silence for the alcoholic that still suffers in and out of these rooms, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that's it. Now, JR, for a few more announcements.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. I'm glad you all could make it. This is a great event. Now, to bring us into the moment and get us ready to experience this Big Book event, I would like to say the following prayer. God, we invite you into this room to guide and direct each of us as we seek your truth. Father, please set aside within each of us that which would block us off from the truth. Lay aside our prejudices about what we think we know about this process, this meeting, and our spiritual condition. Remove our fears, Lord, that we may hear your truth through the members of this group. Give us strength and courage to share your truth with each other in a real spirit of love and compassion for our fellow man. Amen. And it's my pleasure to introduce Don Brown and Mike McKissick. Thank you all.
I'm Don Brown. I'm an alcoholic. I don't think we're needed here. You guys look pretty happy, joyous, and free. I don't. We need misery. We're looking for people down and out, you know, hurting people. I never know what to say. I don't. That's quite a JR. Lay it right on. You sound like my first sponsor, JR. You know how you are, and you're new. You know you. You run to your sponsor and tell them they've asked me to speak at a meeting. Man, you know you're like 90 days sober. Oh! And he said, well, you ought to heard him. He said, you know, he said, you have to be the best alcoholic that you can be in recovery. You may be the only thing that they ever see. Don't put any pressure on me now, you know. Don't make it too tough. Won't you tell them hello, Mike, and then we'll get on with this thing.
I'm Mike McKissick, and I'm an alcoholic.
I guess that's a low. Tell how much I'm going to get out of him. I'd love to have a good time. I called JR the other day. He called me. He said, I'm packing my bag. He wasn't too sure I was coming, I don't think. He liked that. And so he talked about Ditto, and I said, is that your faithful Indian companion, you know? JR and his faithful Indian companion. I nickname people all the time. I got a little joke for you before I start. There was a man and his wife, a future member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and his wife, the future Al-Anon, was driving in a car through a town, and police pulled him over for speeding. And you know how we are. We're never guilty. And so he said, what did you stop me for? And he said, speeding. He said, oh, couldn't be speeding. He said, I have this speedometer checked every 30 days. He said, I'm in the speedometer business, you know. You know what that meant. Let's tell a lie. And so the wife, she leans over and looks around him and said, I told him 10 miles ago to slow down that he was going to get a ticket. And he turned to her, the husband did, and he said, shut up. I'll take care of you and I get home, for God's sake. So the policeman said, besides that, he said, your left taillight's out. Oh, it must have just happened. I look at my lights every time I get in the car. I turn them on and check every one of them, turning signals, brake lights. I haven't stepped on the brake. She leans around to the cop to see him. She says, I told him that was out 6 months ago. Shut up, he says. I'll take care of you and I get home. About this time, the cop, he looks around the old boy and he says to her, does he talk to you that way all the time? That only when he's drunk. I was against the fourth edition book because I got mine so marked up that I just I took the chance to turn it over. But I got a few things I'm going to tell you I've learned about by experience along the way before we get right into this thing. And I'll give you a little outline of what we're going to do. And I asked Mike what part of this he wanted to do, and he said, when you stop talking, he said, I'll try to fill in a little. And I said, okay, if you get your wind back again. But I talked to him. He's pretty good. God does not call the qualified. I failed as a father. I failed as a husband several times in husbands. You just name it. I failed in business. I tried business five times in a row. The one that looked like it was going to work, God said, this is not for you. And I said, oh, not now. You know, you name it. I failed at trying to be a big shot. I failed at trying to be a little shot. I just failed. You know, and today, the most successful thing I've ever gotten any help on, at least, is this thing. So, this is a little story about depression from a lady who did some research. And if you listen to Nell Wing, Nell Wing was an archivist, for those who don't know, and a personal assistant to Bill Wilson. She started out answering the phone there. I like to talk about people and put flesh on them for you. And she came through as a part-time job and answered the phones and finally became his personal assistant and then stayed that way for years. And they didn't come to the office very much, once or twice a week maybe. And they did most of their work at home, and she went out and typed up the work and brought it back to the office, that sort of thing. She knew them personally very, very intimately. How many people have read the new book that's out now about the life story of Lois Wilson? Nobody's got that book yet? That's a great book. It'll bring you to tears. I have feelings today listening to her talk about leaving her home when they threw them out. After 55 years of her family living there. But Nell Wing talks about Bill's depression from 45 to 55. Bill wrote letters about it. I'll talk a little more about it a little later on. A little thing on philosophy, what it might mean. Word glossary of words so we can all be on the same page. Here's a little letter from Bill about a guy. I don't know how this even got in here. I forgot I sent this. This is a fellow who came to California in the early days. His name was Dewey Steves. He comes from Cleveland, Ohio. And this is a letter from Bill telling him that he is 92 or 91 of the first 100. A lot of people didn't know that we had people living out here that were part of the first 100. We had my mind goes blank. I'm getting older. I have no senior moments. Just hang on. You'll understand. This is a four-way test used by Dr. Bob. Comes from the Oxford groups as the test to your prayer and meditation and whether it's you talking or God talking. This is an asset and liability list. We'll go through this a little later. Bill writes on... He's not a professional writer. This is really his first attempt. There's a list put out by Lois of his accomplishments in life, and as we go through the book, we're going to see how they give people asset lists as they go through the book. And so we've learned to do asset lists here. We use them for all sorts of reasons. This we gave you the pages where you're going to find the building of the arch as you go through the book, so it makes it a little easier for you. The foundation is, of course, we're going to work on the first 60 pages. There's a little something for General Service Office about closed and open meetings. Always a lot of confusion about that. I love people that call it an open meeting and then have it closed. They treat it like a closed meeting, but they call it open. They start putting rules on it. This is some directions about taking the 12 steps. This came out of this little inventory package here came out of years of traveling the road and doing these studies in Northern California, and a guy named Terry and I for years. And he went 11 years, I went 13, and then began to not be able to see at night. So I thought it was a good idea to stay at home. And then people called me at home and said, how about, can you find a way to do something? And I said, well, come to the house, you can do that. And so we had over 40 people coming to the house on a regular basis, and that gets pretty small. So we just last Saturday night, the group decided we'd move from the house, and they said, we're sure glad you did that. We've been wanting more people to come, but there's no room. So I'm still doing this kind of stuff all the time. Now, I gave you the pages where to look. and where it talks about pills and drugs, and you've got nothing new on these people, let me tell you, nothing at all. I've been very privileged, I don't want to be a name dropper, I've been very privileged to interview. It's not an advertisement really, but I like things that come to me with what I call no fingerprints on them. Because then I'm real clear about God's will. And one day I got a phone call from a lady named Janine. She says, "You don't know me." Boy, that's a great start. Because there's no manipulation on my end. And she says, "I want to give you some tapes." And I'm a friend of some friends of yours. They said, "It's perfect to give you these tapes." And I said, "Well, okay." And I've had people give me 10 or 12. I sponsor a lot of people. Give me some tapes because they know I'll use them somewhere. And I had a few tapes, maybe 150 of my own I collected over the years listening to different people. And so she said, "Meet me at Mayhew Center." And, of course, the other side of my mind, I'm always wrong. Sweetie tells me to tell you hello. That's my significant other, I guess you'd call her, when you're not married. We've been together for 16 years and it's working, so we don't think we want to change anything. I pay rent at the house. It really works a lot better if you don't have to fight over money. But anyway, she's a great gal. She makes me laugh like crazy. My first wife was almost 6 foot tall, and I've always been prone to tall women, so I have four children, and they're all tall. I've got a boy that's 7 foot tall, and he's up in Oregon. If you want to make a 12-step call, let me know. I'll give you his address. Wish you good luck. And I have youngest boy has been in sobriety now because of rooms like this and people like you, and I need to thank you for that. Nothing I did. 11 years now. And his sister, the youngest girl, who the last time I was packing to leave home was forced to call me a no-good son of a bitch at 10 years of age, and I slunk down the street like a dog because alcohol was more important to me than living with my family. And I understood there wasn't a choice today. And then I have two kids in, and one needs to be. Well, she's never drank any, so don't worry about it. She was suicidal over a breakup of marriage not long ago, so I don't know. If she'd drink, I think we could help her. Kind of let you know about my family a little bit. I come from a long line of alcoholism. My mother was an alcoholic. My biggest resentment, I didn't know that for 3.5 years. I finally got her name on some paper. My stepdad was an alcoholic. My Uncle Dugan was an alcoholic. We just come from a long line of Irish alcoholics, somewhat Irish. There's some German alcoholics in there, too. My real father was an alcoholic. I met him when I was 40. No one ever talked about him. That's what we... I don't know what else you want to call those things. But as you go through here, you'll find some of the things that people are always asking about, like how many times God is mentioned in the book, 119 times, you know, higher power, I think, twice or maybe once. I think they're talking about God most of the time. I love this place. So I'm going to do a quick outline for you of how the book's written. A lot of people think that the first 100 wrote it. There was a man named Jimmy Burwell who came to California, who was the man who was responsible for the third step, as it's written today, God as you understand him. He was an atheist at the time that was going on, big time fights. He is Ed in the 12 for 12. So that kind of finishes up for what happened to him. He eventually shows up one morning. In those days, they would give you a dime, and that was your call. And in those days, they'd go anywhere to get you. And they were so mad at Ed. And in those days, when you got a year, you automatically got to be the speaker, whether they liked you or not. You know, today it's like they got to like you, maybe they let you up there. And Ed gets to speak, who's really Jimmy Burwell, and he gives a great talk about the fellowship. And at that time, New York had gone fellowship while Dr. Bob was holding more to the spiritual side of the program, was having twice as success in sobriety, so eventually they gave it up and went back. But Burwell came to California and was in the real estate and insurance business, and Bill's mother moved to California as a doctor. She was a doctor, and I'll talk a little more about her a little later. And she had married another doctor in the second marriage, and they came to San Diego. And she, the practice, the guy she was married to, his practice was so good she didn't have to work. So she became what was known as the Hetty Green of the West. And Hetty Green was a lady who was playing in the stock market business when that wasn't very popular for women and was very successful. And so her out here, Bill's mother became very successful. She also went to Europe and studied under Adler and tried a little psychiatry for a while. But I get off on these stories a little bit. I got a lot of them. Another guy that lived out here, I'll mention him before I forget him. Anybody, how many people been here quite long? Maybe you knew Charlie Brockwell. He moved out here from the East Coast. He was 5 or 6 in New York, and he met Bill in a drugstore. He had 2.5 years of sobriety, of not drinking, but he wouldn't count his time until he came in here and set his sobriety date in AA. He actually had more time than Bill had dry. And he came to Clear Lake, California, and lived into his 90s, and he was quite one of those kind of characters, you know. But a lot of people, he'd sit around and talk about being one of the first 100, and people would go, that guy don't know what he's talking about. He's a little old and a little slow, you know. Well, he did. Pretty interesting guy. The book is laid out, and the reason they wrote the book is because once they discovered, by counting about 40 people sober in November of 1937, so from 1934 when Bill got sober, December the 11th, he, between that time, had worked with numerous people, and some people say without success. Well, that's just not true. What happened is that as he started to travel, he says 70-some-odd people, and as he traveled the roads at about 10 years sober, the groups began to grow and had enough money to invite him to come out and speak, which he did. And as he did, he started running into some of these people that he had brought the message to earlier. They just hadn't found enough bottom yet to want to do that. He found 62 of them that were in the program. 3 were dead, and the other 5, nobody knows what happened to them. So sometimes this thing is a little different. Actually, in the writing of the book, a lot of people will tell you 100 people wrote the book. That's not true. Burwell says we probably had 100 people around. He said they were coming and going, most of them going. He said there were about 5 people that were very attentive to the working of the book. Bill would dictate to Ruth Hawks. She would double-space the book, what she was writing. She probably wrote the book. He would just put out ideas, and she'd put it in the English language, and then they would sit and discuss what looked good. And then they would send that down to Akron, and they would send it over to New York, double-spaced, and people would make suggestions. In a tape that she did with Sybil Korn in Southern California in the 40s, she said, make no mistake about it, this was Bill Wilson's book. And anything that went in that book, he said what went in the book in the end, which was kind of interesting. So actually, there's a difference between writing something and editing something. Most writers have editing. Their books are edited by other people, but they're not writers. And so what we're going to find in the book is Bill Wilson. If you ever, there's not 2 of us in this room alike. If there is, one of us is not necessary. And so we know today by DNA testing that we're all different. And so you have a mind, and if you decided to write a book, which you could do if you wanted to, it doesn't mean it'd be a bestseller, but you could write one. But it would be from your mind. And as we get to your mind in this book, you're going to find out that that's why it talks about your ideas of God has to be your ideas of God. It can't be nobody else's. And so the idea that I don't believe that I can't change myself, we'll get into that. So that's more or less how the book got written, and eventually they get it out, and in 1937 in November, Bill is down to Akron one more time, meeting with Dr. Bob this time. And some of the miracles of this program, I'll try to go quickly with you. Bill goes to Akron after he's sober about 6 months. Bill had made a lot of money for a lot of people. Bill was like a lot of people I know, kind of like me in a way. I go to school to do this and end up going off and doing that. You know, and so Bill went to school to be a lawyer. He worked some in-between jobs. He just like any other veteran, come home and live with the folks, her folks. They had a huge house. She'd been raised with maids and chauffeurs. And in fact, it was kind of interesting. The guy that was drove the horses and the buggage for them, when cars came in, he retired, and the son drove the chauffeured limousine for him. And so she'd been raised with wealth. Bill was raised with his grandfather was a Scotchman that had a little money, but he didn't look like wealth at that time anyway. Kind of interesting people. Lois talks about Bill's mother, a grandmother. She said she wouldn't take up much space in people's lives. She was very quiet and, you know, just let the world go by. So people say I like to put flesh on people. So as we go along, I'll talk about Dr. Silkworth. There's a lot of books out today, and there's a book list here that I brought. Somebody asked me one time the books I've read. I think I've read everything ever written. In the book of the Lois, by name, she wrote, of course, Lois remembers. Some of you have read that. But this new book is written by a professional who did Bill Wilson. My name is Bill Wilson. And it was at one time supposed to be a combination of the two things, and a big motion picture was going to be made. At least that was his dream. And he couldn't get it done, so they made him an offer to do a TV movie, which they had to shorten it. And this is what was left over. I would love to get the tapes of this interview, because he just sat and talked to her for hours on her back porch and then took it from the tapes. So it's pretty accurate stuff. And she takes on all the rumors in the back of the book, including Bill's supposedly cheating with the women. And I can tell you this, that I can tell you that there are as many people that say that never happened as there are that say it did. So I have no idea. I wasn't there. She takes on the LSD experiment. And I'll talk some about that when we get around to his story a little bit more. He takes on all of these things that we hear all the time. I know if I'm writing a book and I want it to be a successful seller, and I certainly don't want to take other people's inventory, I want to write about sex, murder, gambling, stealing, whatever else gossip I can find. It always sells better, you know. Anyway, I get off of these things sometimes, and I'll get back to where I need to be. They counted 40 people. They had a meeting of 18 in the town of Akron, which decided your faith. And it was an emergency meeting, and they voted on three things. They thought they needed hospitals, which they did. The people in Akron did not see it the same way as the people from New York, because Akron already had a hospital. And so they had a sister up there that had gotten a seven-bed ward with Dr. Bob, the angel of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, great story about her, new book out about her. I believe you ought to read it. It's a great book. She had her own spiritual struggles. They ended up with, they had a doctor, which was Dr. Bob. He's free. Alcoholics love free. And that was a good deal. So what did they need with a hospital and a doctor? They got one. You know, and then they thought they needed paid missionaries because Bob and Bill were collecting a little money off of some money given to them by Rockefeller, about $5,000, and saved Dr. Bob's house. And they picked up about $50 a month or $35 or something like that, a small amount of money, and lived on that while they were carrying the message. And they thought they needed paid message carriers. That makes sense to me. And then they thought they ought to write a book. And these 18 people, like all alcoholics, you give them any kind of authority to make any kind of decision. And for God's sake, they'll take the simplest stuff. And 8 committees later, in 22 years, they might come up with something, you know. But I love us. We're great people. You're the most suspector people I've ever known. You are absolutely the greatest that ever walked, lived. There's one. I see a few people here today from my area. There's a Cajun from down there that brought his faithful Indian companion with him. I see this lady here who lives in our area came up and introduced me. Her sponsor said she's coming up. And I don't know why anybody would come this far except an alcoholic. pay $20 and room rent down here for $100 a night, and then what they could get for free at home. That just don't make sense, but that's all right. I'm glad to see them anyway. They make me smile. They make me smile. Anyway, those are the things, and they vote passed very It was a very tough vote. Dr. Bob had to get on and talk a lot, and they convinced them, and by about the margin of two, I think, these decisions were made, and they said, Bill, if we need money, you need to go to New York and raise it. And that's what he did. And I brought up a tape today and a CD, and I'm sure that you're going to share them. I always bring little gifts with me of Bill in 1954 talking about how the big book was written. And if you listen to that thing, you're going to know there's a God. Absolutely know there's a God. You know, the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous is that an alcoholic in Akron whose business one more time is failing, and based upon his experience of helping another alcoholic, or at least talking to, he had stayed sober for the longest time in his life, which was 6 months, and he knew he had to talk to somebody, and he gets on the phone, and he gets a hold of a guy, I'll shorten it up for you, by the name of Reverend Tunks. And Reverend Tunks was an Episcopal minister, and he said, I'm a rum hound from New York, and I need to find another alcoholic to talk to. Now, if you don't, for us, that's not a strange phone call. But you give that around to normal people, they're going to go, holy man, what kind of a nut have I got on the end of this phone? You know? And this guy said, well, I don't know any personally, but I know some people that might know, and that led him to a woman by the name of Henrietta Stiveling. And Henrietta Stiveling was the head of the Oxford groups in that area and actually sponsored Bill and Bob in the earliest times when they were living there. And 2 weeks prior to that, they had had a meeting, and she had called all the people, and Dr. Bob had been going to the Oxford groups for 2.5 years, Bill for 6 months. They had the same type programs, but Bob couldn't stay sober. And so they had this meeting, and Henrietta, they called it, we're going to share something costly. We do that in AA every day. We tell on ourselves here all the time. I've never been to a church in which somebody gets up and says, you know, I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief, and I can't stay sober, and I've been shooting dope, and I'm going crazy, and I beat my wife, and I'm so ashamed. And you don't hear that much out the church house, you know. Or at least I have never heard it, you know. Maybe I wasn't there enough. That's probably part of the problem. Anyway, I have been dipped and sprinkled and spoken with and talked to, and a lot of things happen. It's a miracle. And she said to Dr. Bob, when you come over next week at our meeting, you're going to share something costly. We're all sharing something costly. And when it came time for his share, he said, first time he ever admitted, I'm an alcoholic and I can't stop drinking. And of course the whole group, not just Dr. Bob, they said, well, would everybody like prayer? And they said, yes. And 2 weeks later, a phone call comes to her house and a man on the other end of the phone says, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a run hound from New York, and I haven't had a drink in 6 months, and I must find another alcoholic to talk to. I don't know what you call that. I don't know what you call that. And he meets Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob, I was fortunate to interview Dr. Bob's son for many days, and it was great. He was a great guy to interview. He had a great sense of humor. And he's the only child. The other one was adopted, but they treated her just like she was the real thing. I'm fascinated by this kind of thing. And so she's a complete stranger. She's from a very wealthy family. Her daddy was a judge down in El Paso, Texas. She was graduated from one of the finest women's schools in this country. That's where she met the guy she married. She marries it wealthy. You'll see that on Castles of America. Stiveling was his name. And, John Stiveling started Goodyear Rubber Company. And so you'll see the 100-some-odd rooms they had in this place. Anyway, that's just amazing. And she says, come right out. Total stranger. And he comes out, and they talk, and they're trying to get him. Bob couldn't come, and he said, I'll go tomorrow. And he told his wife, Ann, I'll give this bum 15 minutes. And Dr. Bob was known as a snappy talker. and stayed about 5.5-6 hours, according to who you're listening to. And the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous really took off. And Dr. Ann Smith said to Bob, why don't you invite Bill to stay with us? Bill ain't got any money. He's broke. And he's married. And a miracle. Bill said yes. Yes, that the mother even asked him, and yes, that he even said yes. And he stayed there, and they didn't know it at the time, but the formation of the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio took place. That's why we have Founders Day there every year. Okay, I'll go. That's enough of that. I'll talk to you in between time. Anything that I can answer, I will. I don't know everything. Some things that you know, I don't know. One of the first things why we used to have conventions in the beginning of conventions was that people would come from all over the country, and they would sit down in the coffee room, and they'd share experience, strength, and hope, and they would talk about their groups, and what do you do about this, and what do you do about that, you know. And they were just, that's the way we're founded. So they decided to write this book, and they did so. And how is the book laid out? Well, the book is laid out with the first 60 pages to convince you. You come to page 60, the book says, after the ABCs, which are the first two steps, it says, being convinced. Being convinced of what? Being convinced of the first two steps. It says we're at step three. Once I'm convinced. What is step three? Step three is the decision to go 4 through 9 to get into fit spiritual condition. If you do that and you do 10 and 11, you can stay in fit spiritual condition. Does that make sense to you? And 12 is the work. My first sponsor says the only step you can work out of order is 11. And when we get to 11, we're going to look at the 24-hour program. That's what 11 is. It was called, it'll put you to bed, it'll wake you up, it'll take you through the day. All you had to do is follow the directions. And in the long run, the book served as sponsor. How's that for you? Does that make any sense to you? So the book, and the idea was that if they kept going the way they were and they could only get 40 people sober in a few years, my God, the alcoholics are dying left and right. And so they needed a way to get it out there. And a number of the states in the United States actually started on the book. Now I'll give you this little story. There's a lady by the name of Mrs. Oram, and she's renting rooms. She's newly married, and it's 1939, and the great crash of 29, and her husband's a contractor and his brother, and they have this upper floor of these big mansions, and they have a bedroom and a living room and a bath and a kitchen, and downstairs they have three bedrooms and a bath, and she's renting the rooms out, trying to help out, keep the family going, and she rents to a guy by the name of Ted C., and Ted C. is an alcoholic. He is a periodic, according to some history. But every time he goes completely off, and he sees the nut houses more than the average person 5 or 6 times. And she takes a real interest in him and tries to help him. There was a man by the name of Gabriel Heater years ago that had a radio program. If you're as old as me, you might remember that guy. And he was a very snappy guy, you know, to the ships at sea, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. And he'd give you this story behind the story. And people, he was a big-time guy. And there's a fellow by the name of Morgan Ryan. And Morgan Ryan had just gotten out of the Greystone Asylum, and they were trying to figure out how to get the message out. And he says, I know Gabriel Heater because I used to be in the advertisement business, and if you'll let me approach him, I think he'll let me be on his program. And he was. And he got on the program, and he did a fine job. The only problem that they had with him was that they figured out he hadn't been sober but a few days. And out of Greystone, they weren't too much sure they could trust him, and this was so important that they got a room down to YMCA. They locked him up for 2 weeks and guarded him to make sure he's going to be sober for the show. And Morgan didn't make it, unfortunately, but he did a fine act in that one. And she heard that show. That was one of her favorite shows. She sent and got the first book to come to Northern California that I know of. Now, up here in this area, there might have been something a little earlier. I don't know. But that's the first one, at least in the San Francisco area, that was to show up. And, of course, it was read. Okay, so we kind of got an outline of the book, so let's go to work here and see if we can't figure out some of this book. I can tell you what I do a lot of. On the front of my book, I write God stories. They're my God. So God is an experience, and I've had lots of God experiences in this program, and I write God stories in the front of the book. And the reason I do that is because if I begin to get a little lost or something like that, or I get a little doubtful of what's going on, I go to my God stories. And it always helps me. And if you make a list of God stories in your life, I guarantee you. I didn't finish the tape story. See how I wander off? Anyway, this gal tells me to come down to Mayhew Center and what they don't want I can have. And going down there, I'm saying, they'll take all the good stuff. I'll get all the bad stuff, you know. I'm always wrong. That's the watchword at our house. My sweetheart and I are always saying to each other, aren't you tired of being wrong? You know, because I'm always wrong. I don't know why. I think I can think, you know. So anyway, I ended up going down there, and she, I walked over, and she ran over and introduced herself, and she said, they don't want any of them. I said, really? I mean, the most anybody ever gave me was like 20 one time, you know. And of course, my mind thinks in 20. You know? I said, how many do they have? She said, 5,000. I said, wow, 5,000. What are we doing here, God? So I pack them up in about 30 reels, and I put them in the car, and I take them home, and I'm sitting there, and I'm pushing stuff. Sweetie's got the garage full of stuff. None of my stuff is. I'm pushing her stuff around and making room, and I'm saying to God, what are we doing here? He said, inventory. I said, okay, I can do that. So I put them in ABCs. About a week and a half later, I'm not going to go into a long story about this, through a whole series of things, I ended up with 15,000 more. And so I said, what am I doing here, God? And my dedication to this library is to record everything from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s I can put my hands on. So if there's anybody here that has any of that old recordings, if you'll let me know, I'll put them on CD for free for you, just to get them. And I clean them up and all that. That's come a long way. And I now support 5 libraries throughout the country. So I want to get that old message back out here again. So we're going to take a look at a little bit. We'll get into the additions a little bit. And I'm not going to mess with the story part. You can look at those. But I am going to start with the XI. If you have XI in your book, and it's called the preface. And we'll talk about, this is the third edition. And everybody with me? I'll run off and leave you. Sometimes you have to slow me down once I get rolling. I act like an alcoholic on speed. You know how to, if you ever go out to I used to. I don't do it so much anymore. I'm getting a little older. Somebody asked me the other day how old I was, and I said, I'm 82. And they said, my God, you look good for 82. And I said, that's because I'm 72. But that's, so now you know what kind of guy you got in front of you. You can't trust, I can't even trust me, so I don't know, you know. So he said, this is the third edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first edition appeared in April of 1939. And in the following 16 years, more than 300,000 copies went into circulation. The second edition, published in 1955, reached a total of more than 1,150,000 copies, which I think proves that their idea of getting the book out there was a good idea, and it worked pretty well. Because this book has become the basic text, what kind of a book is a textbook? Every one of you knows what a textbook is. It's what they gave you when you went to school. The one where you tore the pages out and ate them, you know. The ones that you didn't want to open up and look at, you know. The one that the girl in front of you was good at and you copied over her shoulder. That's what I did. So to help such large number of alcoholic men and women to recover, there exists a sentiment against any radical change being made in it to this day. The fourth edition did not change the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. It changed the stories to bring it more current. So, has been left untouched, of course, a revision made for both the second and the third edition. The section called The Doctor's Opinions Kept Intact. This is originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor. What a guy. They've got a book out on him nowadays. Great story. The second edition added the appendices, the 12 traditions, and the directions for getting in touch with AA. But the chief change was in the section of personal stories, which was expanded to reflect the fellowship's growth. Bill's stories, Dr. Bob's nightmare, and one other personal history from the first edition was retained intact. 3 were edited, and one of these was retitled. New versions of 2 stories were written. With new titles, 30 complete new stories were added, and the story section was divided into 3 parts under the same heading that is used now. In the third edition, part 1, Pioneers of AA stands unchanged. 9 of the stories in part 2, they stopped in time, are carried over from the second edition. 8 new stories have been added. In part, they lost nearly all. 8 stories have been retained. 5 are new. I don't know why that's so important. All changes made over the years of the Big Book, AA's members' fond nickname for this volume, have had the same purpose, to represent the current membership of Alcoholics Anonymous more accurately. That's exactly right. And thereby to reach more alcoholics. If you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 44 personal stories and think, yes, that has happened to me. It's a book of experience. It is a book written for alcoholics, by alcoholics, and to alcoholics. Normal people, unless you're very good, will not understand this book. It won't make sense to them because it doesn't have an experience to them. So it said, and more important, yes, I felt like that. Or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. What the stories are in the book for is to help you to be convinced. And many old timers in the part of the different parts of the, this AA is not done the same all over. Please believe me. And so if you show up somewhere and you've never been there before and they don't start the meeting with how it works, don't get excited. It's still AA. That's wonderful. Up here in the Hill Country, some of them, they read more about alcoholism. Anybody been to some of those meetings up here? Yeah, they read more about alcoholism. And they do it really well, too. I know some of them can quote it. In the original text, they wrote a 400 loose leaf manuscript as part of the sales device with this program that Morgan Ryan was going to be on with Gabriel Heater, the obvious quick-thinking Hank Parkhurst, who Bill said was quicker than he ever thought of being, and he was pretty quick, suggested that they take the last of their money and put out a 3x5 card and write to doctors west of the Mississippi River and to send out everything that they could to all those that might be interested. And they got back. They were so disappointed. They went down with suitcases, if you can believe that. And they were so disappointed, and he looked in the little glass part, and there was like 10 or 12 cards in there, 8, something like that, not very many. Only 3 of them were legible, written by drunk doctors, and you can't read their handwriting. And they've been using them with the glass sitting on them, stained them. But they were very disappointed, and then the sheriff came and moved them out. It was you just go through that CD I brought you, and you believe that we're here as a miracle. And in the original story, they had 28 stories. And of the 28, 14 of them stayed sober. It's amazing. Now, we're not talking about lightweight, I drank a little too much booze, and I felt bad on Sundays. Most of these people have been in the insane asylum. They'd been in Joe's Rose. He'd been in Bellevue 32 times, 8 times in the mental hospital. And he will come out to get sober. 14 got drunk. Of the 14 that got drunk, 7 came back, which gave them a 75% rate of recovery. Now, that's amazing. Clarence Snyder talks about a 93% rate of recovery in some of his history writing. I believe him. And I know that Bill Wilson talks about an 85% rate of recovery. And I have sponsored enough people that I can take 100 plus many, many more and tell you my rate of recovery is around, not mine, but God's rate of recovery with what I'm doing through this book is about 85%. And I have many of them are dead today. I have a box of people that I couldn't get past the third step, and I put them in a box, and that's where they're at. And I don't really die a lot of times. It's a sad thing, and I tell people when I sponsor, I'm going to be, if you don't run from me, I won't run from you, and I will stay with you whether you die from this disease or whether you. And so I attend the funerals. I think that's part of my responsibilities. Let's look at the forward to the first edition. And we're going to start with, this is the forward as it appeared the first printing of the first edition. I do this because there's a lot of history here. It said, we have Alcoholics Anonymous of more than 100 men and women who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. There is no known cure to alcoholism. It is one of the oldest diseases in recorded history. You can read about it in Proverbs of the Bible. Great description by Solomon. You can read about it. It goes back. Magnum Husk is a guy. I won't go into all that stuff. But he's a guy that was a doctor from over in Europe somewhere. Who said he coined the word alcoholic. But he was a doctor. So they've been dealing with us for a long time. They've tried everything in the world. They've tried every medication in their pharmacies. They have done all kinds of things. They used to, in the 20s, right up into the 30s, they used to think this was hereditary, and they would take you to the insane asylum where they just signed, anybody could almost put you in, and they would sign you up, and of course it doesn't take but about 4 days, 72 hours to get the alcohol out of us, and we're back to being almost normal. That's what drives us, psychiatrists crazy, you know. We act crazy when we're drinking, but when we're sober, we act much like normal people, because we are. That's the whole story. And seemingly hopeless state of mind and body comes from the idea that the world, the doctors at least, said there's no medical cure for this thing. So we shouldn't recover. So seemingly not supposed to recover. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Does that make sense to you? So they wrote it down. They wrote the formula for recovery in this book. It is the first time that I know of that's ever happened. We are the longest lasting society of men and women in the face of this earth. We've never been here before. We have had more, we are nothing as close to us. I had some people talking to me the other day about they know people have stayed so. May be true. There's nobody even close to us. There's about 2.5 million of us. Never has happened before. Never. Not in the face of history. So you have to read the history of alcoholism, but I don't have time to do all that. But if you want to, there's lots of good books around. There's lots of history to read. And I guarantee you that you get an understanding from that historical, this is not supposed to happen. We're not supposed to be here. 97% of all alcoholics will die untreated. We're a very small percentage. But of that percentage, those who take the steps, we give them a 75% opportunity to recover. So that's the basic figure. And so it's important that we give away what works and not what we think. I'm not into that stuff at all. So it says to show other alcoholics precisely how recovery is the main purpose of this book. Precisely is the key word. For then we hope that these pages will prove so convincing no further authentication will be necessary by your own experience. We think this account of our experience will help will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. It took years to convince people this wasn't sin, or it wasn't some kind of self thing that you're doing to hurt yourself, that it was a true disease. So, and that's what Marty Mann and the National Council was all about, and there's some miracle stories over there, too. So, they think that everybody ought to read the book. And so in the early days, as we're going to see, when we get to working with others, we get the idea that this, they're just talking about 12-step work with other alcoholics. There wasn't anybody else around but us in those days. And so to wives, to the family afterwards, and to the employer, all about us working with those people. And it'll give you a little different view of the book a little bit. Today, a lot of that's gone away because of the fact that Al-Anon came in, some of that went away. And when doctors and hospitals begin to take us in, some of that went away. So you don't see the wet 12-step work today that you used to see, which I think is very important. I have a sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. I got one now. He's quite a guy. He's really funny. He's got funny stories about 12-step work. It says, and besides, we're sure our way of living has its advantages for all. Absolutely. Why would that be? Well, I asked my first sponsor, I said, because I had gotten past, I had this band on my arm that told me that I was in a hospital somewhere, knew everything, right? When he asked me questions, I wanted to hand him my CEO card. He looked at me like I was nuts, and I was. I said to him, what is a principle, John? And I thought I knew what it was. He said, it's the truth of law that governs the spirit. Now, that's a whole interesting concept. Because if it's a truth or law that governs the spirit, then it applies to not just alcoholics. It applies to all people. And anybody who will live this way of life will get the same results. Behind every step, there's a principle, and I'll give them to you in a little while. They vary from place to place. You may say, well, that's not what my sponsor told me. Well, use what you got, you know. AA is not the same everywhere. So it says, here's the first time they talk about what we call traditions. It says it's important we remain anonymous because we're too few at the present to handle the overwhelming numbers of personal appeals which may result from this publication. Being mostly business or professional folks, we could not well carry on our occupation at such an event. We'd like it understood our alcoholic work is an avocation, something we did after we earned the living for the family, if that makes sense to you. When writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each of our fellowship to admit his personal name, designating himself instead as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, my, I could give you hours and hours of discussion on it. you know, alcoholics are all, they come in and they think nothing's ever happened that's new like this, and maybe we ought to get on the radio. And I tell them that's already been done. They've been on stages with masks on. They've been with their backs to the crowd. You know, they've done a little bit of everything. There's a guy named Eddie, which was called the Prince of the 12-Steppers in San Francisco. Fitzgerald, I think his last name was. And Eddie married a San Salvadorian girl and moved to San Salvador in the early days of AA, and he is AA. And he starts AA down there. Well, they get so interested in all this thing that they put it on the radio at siesta time. It's like as the world turns, you know. And they would have the woman on saying, "Will Jack drink tomorrow?" You know. And the whole outfit, the whole country just, they fell in love with the thing. They just get on it. They did the same thing in San Francisco. So all this stuff's been done. Don't get excited about any of it. When writing or speaking publicly about alcohol, we urge each of our fellowship to admit his personal name, designating himself instead of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not practice anonymity in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I practice anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. Wilson said, if I practice anonymity in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess the way you get a hold of me is you call the operator and say, "Hey, I'm a drunk, and I need a drunk like Don Brown to talk to. He's about 6'7", weighs about 300 pounds. You happen to know where he lives?" I mean, that don't work. You got to tell him your name. So we earnestly ask the press also to observe this request, for otherwise we should be greatly handicapped. We're not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking, and they dropped that. They decided no alcoholic could be honest. Well, mainly because when you get into the disease, I cannot tell the truth from the false, because the disease blinds me through an obsession. There's no way for me to truly be honest. So they took that out, just drinking nowadays. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. God, we're the greatest people in the world, I'm telling you. Have you ever been in a meeting where a wet drunk comes in? I love it. And the other alcoholics get their nose up in the air. Like, "Do you see that? Holy mackerel, look at that. What are we doing here?" This is what we do. You know, all of a sudden we get real prideful. "Oh, I've been sober, you know. What? No, you terrible guy, you." You know. Well, we're not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. That's a great lesson. We do not oppose anyone or any place or anything. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results. Oh, I'm sorry. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. That's it. That's all. Let me tell you the highest office in this land of AA. Do you know what it is? Sober. That's the highest you can get here. You're not going to get no higher. So you just accept that and live with it. Sober. That's it. So it says, we shall be interested to hear from those who are getting... This is New York now. They're talking about Bill. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced to work with other alcoholics. Sponsorship. We should like to be helpful to such cases. Inquiries by scientific, medical, and religious societies will be welcome. They didn't know the book was going to work. They didn't know it was going to work. So they, I want to hear what's going on. And it worked. Forward to the second edition. Figures given in the forward to the second edition. Describes the fellowship as it was in 1955, so they're going to give you some history from somewhere around June the 10th. Some of Bill's in here too. So around June the 10th, what we call of 35 to about 20 years, and they're going to give you a little history. So since the original forward to the book was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. That is correct. That is absolutely true. When we get to talking about self-worth, that's when my friend Mike gets to talk. I'll give you some facts about him. This disease beat him into submission so that he could accept what happened in his hospital when it was not scientific. Do not look for scientific results here. the brightest people of the world have never, I'm done, have never figured it out. Never. Carl Jung, the great psychiatrist, called it a phenomenon. This doctor here was a pretty good guy, Silkworth, said, I don't understand it. Didn't have to understand. I love AA people. Well, I have to understand it before I can do it, you know. Right? So that's good. Smartest guys in the world can't figure it out. So, he said, our earliest, Wholesale America said, our earliest spreading voice of hope that every alcoholic whose journey will find the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. Why? Because you have a solution. That's what separates you from everybody else. That solution we talk about is called, there is a solution. That's what makes AA different than anything else out there. And it works. Obviously, testimony in this room. So, we're not, people come in and see us sometimes, and I think they think that we are group therapy. We are not group therapy. I'm here to apply a spiritual solution to a physical and mental problem in which there is no known cure. That's the only reason we're here. And if they come up with something, Bill never wanted them to stop looking. And if they could ever find a cure other than this that produces more than 75%, let me know. I'll go join them. The disease is that powerful. It's still killing most of the people that have it. So it says already, continues the early text, twos and threes and five of us have sprung up in other communities. That's it. We are the true grassroots work here. When they thought they had to have paid message carriers, what did they get? They got us. I don't know if anybody works for money. Well, there's a difference between working in treatment centers and being carrying a spiritual message. But and they're necessary. They're good things to have. I really like that. 16 years has elapsed between our first printing of this book and the presentation in 1955 of our second edition. In that brief space, Alcoholics Anonymous has mushroomed into nearly 6,000 groups whose membership is far above 150,000 recovered alcoholics. There's no plan, like a business plan. There wasn't a business plan. We're not an autonomy. The freedom that you have to move spiritually as God would have you is what developed this program. And there's many inspiring stories of people who did exactly what they thought they ought to do. There's no central office to tell them anything. They stepped out and did what they thought God ought to have them do. We are amazing. I get letters. I got guys I sponsor that are at Akbar or Arabia. My God, it's hard to feature that, isn't it? I said to him the other day, I said, he found out, he's pretty tight, but he's smart. He found out on the computer how to call me for 4 cents a minute, and we're talking. And I said, well, how's the meetings? He said, well, we got one. He's 35 years sober, this guy. He said, we got one with a guy that's about as dry as I was when I was 20 years sober. And he said, I can't stand him, so I don't go there. And I said, well, how's your meeting? And he said, well, we have Buddhists and Muslims and all kinds of people and Sufis. And he said, it's great. We have great discussions. I said, well, what do you do? And he said, we listen to your recordings on Friday for 2 hours. I said, oh, give me a break. Anyway. Yeah, I'm telling you. So it groups would be found in each of the United Hundred said whose membership is far above 150,000 recovered alcoholics. Never had happened in the world before. Some people talk about the Washingtonians. The Washingtonians probably, according to what estimate you want to believe, they talk about 600,000 people, but all of those were not alcoholics. And it's because they were letting everybody in. About 150,000 maybe alcoholics, but they didn't last long. Groups are defined in each of the United States, all the provinces of Canada, as flourishing communities in the British Isles, the Scandinavian countries, South Africa, South America, Mexico, Alaska, Australia, and Hawaii. All told, promising beginnings have been made in some 50 countries and U.S. possessions. Some are just now taking shape in Asia. Many of our friends encourage us by saying that this is but a beginning, only the auger of a much larger future ahead. Augers are the tips of a bit. Here's a little history for you. The spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June of 1935 during a talk between the New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drinking obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. I'll give you a definition to help you along here. Experiences are something that takes place right now. That's usually accompanied with, in Bill's case, wind of spirit. Some kind of audio things happen sometimes, but it's an experience that takes place. It's transformation of Paul to Saul right now kind of thing. Awakenings is the way I came to it over a period of time. And in this program, if you stay with it, you will develop over a period of time. Following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day, his name was Evie Thatcher. The alcoholic friend, Evie Thatcher. Might as well tell you the story of Evie, another miracle. Evie's dad, George, was a very rich man. He had a foundry. They made iron stoves in the days that iron stoves were being sold. They also made trains for wheels. There was six brothers, or seven of them. I guess two of them died. Five of them, I think, existed. Brother Jack was the mayor of Albany. Evie was a drunk. Everybody worked for Dad's company. And they started up from the bottom, and that's how they learned the business. When his dad died, the crash of 29 had hurt him some, like it did a lot of rich people, but they still had some, and Evie inherited his part of the money. Evie was an embarrassment to the family because Jack would be political and have drinking at the political parties, and Evie would show up for the free booze, and he looked a lot like Jack, and everybody said the mayor is drunk, and it really wasn't the mayor, it was the brother. And you know, yeah. Did you ever hear of money from home? Rich people used to get rid of their problems by sending them away somewhere and send them money to support them and say, if you come home, we'll cut off your money. So that's how they kept them out there. And that's what Evie kind of is doing up. And he goes up to Manchester. It's a very rich community, much like some of Tahoe areas. And people that lived there had a lot of money. And Bill's about 7 or 9 miles from there is where he was raised. And he went to school there. That's how he got to know the factory. And they had a what they called blue laws in those days, 3 strikes and you're out kind of deal. And if you were in drunkenness of any kind in that town 3 times, you went to the nut house. And or if you'd committed a crime, you got to go to jail. Now, Evie's dad, even though he was dead, I'll show you how big-timer he was. He did business with a kid by the name of Todd Lincoln, who was Abraham Lincoln's son. And they built a golf course which still exists and a hotel that still exists in Manchester and is played in the PGA today. So his dad was no small potatoes guy. And, of course, they go before a judge, and after the 3 strikes you're out, I won't go through the stories, there's lots of stories about it, and he ends up in front of the judge. And he should have gone to the insane asylum at Brattleburg was the name of the place. And instead of that, as they're talking, thank you, as they're talking, a young man by the name of Seaver Graves was there, and a guy named Shep Cornell was there, who were schoolmates of Bill's, of Evie and Bill, really. And another guy by the name of Roland Hazard. And the Hazard family, there's another big-time guy. Roland Hazard's family owned linen mills. They had 5 big mills. They came over on the Mayflower. They have an archives of their own family history that's huge. This guy was being, when we get to Roland, we'll talk a little more about him, but he is being groomed to run these companies. And that company is now today Burlington Industries. That'll give you an idea of the size of this thing. And they were interested in coloring their cloth, and they have allied chemical. That's where Roland Hazard came from. That's who he was being groomed to operate in, and he couldn't stay sober. And that's he'd been educated and trained to do that. So he'd gotten sober in the Oxford groups, and he comes to court. And an interesting thing, there are some honest people out there. There are some good, good people out there. And so this guy, this Graves, is making a plea to the court. And he's saying, would you please not put him in the insane asylum? Would you please give him to Roland and parole him in Roland's name, and perhaps we could help him? And the guy sitting on the bench said, I'll do that. Very unusual. Wonder why. I don't know what you call this, but I call it the hand of God. His name was Judge Graves, and Seaver was his son. And Roland Hazard had helped his son to get sober. And he had enough honesty and respect, probably for George, to give Evie a chance. And that's how Evie gets to New York. And he's working at the mission in New York that Sam Shoemaker's church owned, the Calvary Mission, goes to see Bill, which we'll see more of that story. So he goes, now Bill, when he went to school, he went to an electrical engineering school called Northwich. They also had a state militia there, which he joined, which is how he gets to be a lieutenant later on. And he gets to the junior year. They have a hazing incident, and they're thrown out. World War I breaks out, and they bring the class back because they need people. And in that school, they taught him how to solve a problem. So he knew how to solve a problem. First, you got to know what the problem is, first step of our program. You got to know what the problem is. I'm powerless over alcohol. That's my problem. And my life is unmanageable. Now, the second thing he knew was that you need a solution. And he's going to get this solution. He's going to get the problem from Silkworth as we read a little further. He's going to get the solution from Carl Jung. He called him a co-founder of AA through Roland Hazard, through the Oxford groups. And he's going to, and he needs a plan, program of action to solve the problem. So first he says, what is the problem? I'm powerless over alcohol. What's my solution? Gain to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. What's the plan, program of action to apply the solution which will solve the problem? My son is up in Oregon one day, an example. We go up to visit. I don't fight the disease. We go camp and I buy him a case of beer. I don't want him to suffer, you know. Or I'm trying to help him get to his bottom one. I don't know which. Anyway, he tells me, oh, Dad, he says, I've got this car, and it's out. The fuel pump quit working on it. I said, okay. So I said, don't worry about it, son. We'll go by and pick up some. I'll get your brother, and we'll come by and pick it up. You got some tools? Yeah, I got some with me. So we get the tools, about $20 worth. We go out there, and we go to work on this thing. And we put a new fuel pump on it. It still don't run. I said, are you sure you got gas? Oh, yeah, Dad. It's out of gas. My friends told me it's out of gas. I ain't going to go with that. That's the problem. Okay. Well, we're getting hot, and it's not running. So we decided we better bring in one of them shade yard. He lives out in the country. He always got a shade yard mechanic up there. And so we call in one, an expert. He comes in the next day, and he says, you got gas? And he says, oh, sure, I got gas. And so he says, okay, take the cap off. He don't believe him. Good mechanic. He goes and takes the line off to the fuel pump, and he says, I'm going to blow through here, and if you don't hear any bubbles, you ain't got no gas. So the kid's going, he don't hear nothing, but he don't want to admit that it's wrong. And so he said, well, I can't hear nothing. Now, let me blow on the thing. So he goes and blows on it. The guy reaches over, gets 2 gallons of gas, pours it in the car, hooks everything back up, and we run. I said, how much owe you? He said, nothing. I gave a great big old roll we'd gotten that morning at breakfast. He took that. But if you don't know what the problem is, now the solution ended up that we now have 2 fuel pumps at work. So, no, that's the whole deal here. If you don't understand the problem, he had that formula in his mind. And so when he heard the people talk, he knew when he heard what he needed. That's how this thing just didn't come by accident. It came. Maybe it's God's will. I mean, he had to have that information to make this work. So he goes on and he says, the Oxford groups of that day, my friend had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who's now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, whose story of the early days of our society appear in the next pages. Now, he's going to tell you what he got from the doctor. He got step one. He said, from this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism, mental obsession, and physical allergy. That's what he got from him. He knew the problem. I've got a mental obsession and a physical allergy. I'm not just a bum. I'm not just crazy. There's something really wrong with me. And that made sense to him. See, the alcoholic has to work from his experience. And it has to relate to what the doctor said. That's the reason why you can talk to another alcoholic like nobody else can. So he says, from the doctor, he had learned the grave nature of alcoholism, though he didn't He said, though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group. Have I skipped something here? Yeah. No, I'm all right. Grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets. Tenets are principles. Of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory. We have a moral inventory. It's called step four. He says, confession of personal defects. We have that. It's called step five. He says, restitution to those harmed. We call it eight and nine. Helpfulness to others. We call it step 12. Practice these principles in all of our affairs. And the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. We call it 2, 3, and 11. Does that make sense to you? That's what he extracted from a huge program of the Oxford group. The Oxford groups were started by a guy named Frank N.D. Bookman. He was a Lutheran Harvard graduate. He will never marry. And he believed that the church had gone astray, much like Martin Luther had. And so he set out on what they called the first century Christianity, which he wanted to return to the roots of the Bible and practice Christianity exactly and as close as they did at that time. And from that, he developed all kinds of stuff. And if you want to know about the Oxford group in more depth, read anything by Dick Burns. You cannot go wrong with Dick Burns. So he's written, I've read every book he ever wrote. I quit looking for history when I found him. So there's where your steps come from. Now, I can show you, you know what page that's on where the Dr. Bob's working with, you remember that story? Well, I'm going to look for it here. I don't know why I can't. Oh, here it is. I lucked into it. 292 of the third edition. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, 292. You may not have it in the fourth edition book, but in a third edition book you'll have it. That's why I kind of hate all this stuff. 263 in the fourth edition. Ah, there's the help we needed right there. I knew somebody would come through for us. I told you I was dumb. I have senior moments. Don't get too excited if I say, what am I doing here? That's So we're going to see an example of Dr. Bob working steps. And this gentleman's name, I'll get over here to his name, give you a little history on him. His name is Earl Treat, and he starts AA in Chicago, Illinois. His date of sobriety was 7 to 37. And Sylvia Kaufman helped him. He's AA number 13 in Akron. He also suggested that the points should be called traditions rather than points to assure our sobriety. He had one slip. He was on the board of trustees a couple of years. So he says, Wednesday, and Dr. Bob, I'm right at the top of the page, afternoon off. He had me down at the office and spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. Formally going through the six-step program. So he says, one, complete deflation. We call it powerlessness. Two, dependency and guidance from a higher power. We call it 2, 3, and 11. Three is moral inventory. He got sober in April of 1937. So I know about when these steps were being. He lived with Dr. Bob. In fact, his young Smith knew him. That's what I like about young Smith. He was 82. He's dead now, but that's what I liked about him. He knew all these people. He says, three, moral inventory. We call it step four. Five, we call it confession. Four is confession. Five is restitution, 8 and 9. And six is continue to work with other alcoholics, 10, 11, and 12. When Bill goes into the hospital, he asks Ebby, what is that formula for getting sober? And Ebby gave him 5 points to work with, which over the years, somewhere or another, had folded into 6, however you look at it. And they were changed around the country from time to time a little bit. Here's what sponsors do. Dr. Bob led me through all these steps, and at the moral inventory, he brought up some of my bad personal traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. Dr. Bob is a tough sponsor. I could hear him now. You're a lying SOB. No. We went over these at great length, he says. And then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. We call it step six today. And when I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away, step seven. And I do that sometimes today with people, and I know some sponsors that still do that. He says the picture is still vivid, and if I live to be 100, it will always stand out in my mind. I was very impressed. I wish that every AA could have the benefit of the type of sponsorship today. Do not. The word sponsorship has been with us from the very beginning. It came over from the Oxford groups. Some people say there's no mention of sponsorship in this book. Oh, yes, there is. And if you look in that deal I gave you, go find out what page it's on. It's always been with us. It's suggested in Bill's story from the beginning. And we'll be looking at it. In which I made it, I know it helped. It said, sponsorship. Dr. Bob always emphasized the religious angle very strongly, and I think it helped. I know it helped me. Dr. Bob led me through the restitution steps, we call it 8 and 9, in which I made a list of all persons I had harmed. And I worked out ways and means of slowly making restitution, we call it 9. I made several decisions at that time. One of them was I would try to get a group started in Chicago. The second was that I would have to return to Akron to attend meetings at least how often? I want to see if you're reading. Every 2 months. Hold it. How'd that guy stay sober? My God, how do you do that? 2 months? Well, I'll die without a meeting. I could barely get up here. He's going to have to drive me home tonight so I can make my meeting, you know. Obviously, I'm making a little joke. Obviously, these people did not believe that you stayed sober on meetings. Not that meetings help. I go to more meetings. Don't get me wrong. I go to more meetings accidentally than most people do on purpose. But so he said, until I could get a group started in Chicago, third, I decided I must, and this is very important, I must place this program above everything else, even my family, because I did not maintain my sobriety, I would lose my family anyway. Okay. So if I did not maintain my sobriety, I'd have no friends left. I had few enough at the time. Yes? Yes?
Before you leave that story, if you, you started out on 263, but on 262, it's at the bottom of that page, it says, I stayed in Akron 2 or 3 weeks. And you talk about how long it took Ed to get through the steps. He came to Akron 2 or 3 weeks trying to absorb much of the program. And on the, this is the day he's going back to Chicago. So in less than 21 days, you know, this story was, this man had been through the steps.
I'm going to let you in a few minutes. Just hang on.